Give me an example of an experience you've had, either at the Renewable Fuels Association or, you know, any other past professional experience that you believe will prepare you as a member of Congress.
That's an excellent question, because I think it's important that we elect someone, and well, as Republicans, we nominate someone who won't just vote right, that's very important, but who will also be effective. And both my time at Renewable Fuels as well as my time on the State Central Committee for the Republican Party, I think, have helped get me ready for that. We were able to focus people on the big issues. I think back to we had a big discussion on the voter program in 2010 and how to do that, and we were able to bring people together, focus on the facts, focus on what we wanted to accomplish. And the party really did a fundamentally different get-out-the-vote program than we had in the past, and it was very effective in 2010. So that would be one example. As executive director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association, there's been several times on legislation where we've worked across party lines to get things done. I've actually been criticized for working for a group that's bipartisan or nonpartisan, and I find that humorous because look, I'm not afraid to stand up for my conservative principles, but not every issue needs to be partisan. And the key thing is to get stuff done. So we've been able to get key tax credits in place at a state level that have really powered the renewable fuels industry and therefore Iowa's economy.
I'm glad you brought up the bipartisan nature of your association, the Renewable Fuels Association, because you've gotten some criticism because the association's donated more money to Democratic than Republican candidates, including Stacey Apple. I know you weren't part of this decision since you're not a voting member of the board, but does it say anything to voters if the organization in which you are the executive director is supporting your Democratic opponent?
Well, first of all, that was back in like 2006 or 10 or whatever. But the key thing here, a couple facts. First of all, once someone made that claim, a person with the organization actually went back and added it up, and the IRFA has actually given more money to Republicans than Democrats. Someone forgot to include a few things. So it's funny how that works. But the association never really looked at the R's and D's. My job as executive director was to put the voting records in front of these folks, to put the candidate surveys that we do in front of these folks. And then it's the board's job to make up their mind. These are men and women who run successful companies, who are competing successfully against the world's most profitable and powerful industry. They're quite capable of making up their own minds. And if you look at the voting records, people were for us or people were against us, and the decisions were really pretty straightforward. I don't think working for a single-issue organization that happens to be nonpartisan makes you a bad Republican. After all, the NRA, the National Rifle Association, gives money to Democrats. Does that mean anyone who supports the NRA or whoever worked for the NRA is therefore a bad Republican? I don't think so.
Oh, I'm glad we got to clear that up. What do you think is one thing you can do in Congress? Sorry about that.
No, I'm trying to turn these off, but I just heard one go off.
So do you have a phone for work and a phone for home and a phone for Congress?
I have eight phones, and now I carry two, which means I'm doubly annoyed.
What's one thing you can do in Congress to help create jobs?
Well, that is one of my number one focuses. I mean, really, I got into this race because I've got a son and a daughter, and I'm seeing their economic future literally buried under a mountain of debt and spending and regulations. And the way to get out of that is to have pro-growth policies combined with spending restraint. And the pro-growth policies would be getting our tax code reformed, simplified, reduced, so that we don't punish success, so that small businesses have the certainty they need to invest and hire people, because it's all interconnected. When you grow the economy, you do that with investment, and investment means jobs, and jobs mean more people pulling the wagon than sitting in the wagon, and then that means more tax revenue to the government. So the debt, the spending, the jobs and the growth are all tied together, and that's my number one priority in Congress. So I would look at getting rid of onerous regulations. The EPA, the Department of Labor, they've gone out of control in the last 6 years and are just really hurting our small businesses. And then we've got to get the tax code under control. It punishes success. It punishes growth instead of rewarding it. And so we've really got the system turned upside down today.
An Iowa March poll shows that 65% of those polled support an increase in the minimum wage. Would you support an increase in the minimum wage?
Not at the federal level, no. I don't think it makes any sense to have the same minimum wage in Brooklyn, Iowa as in Brooklyn, New York. Two fundamentally different areas, two fundamentally different cost of livings. So if states want to look at that, they have the right to look at that, and some have done it. Iowa's done that in the past, has had a higher minimum wage than the rest of the country. But no, I think it's a mistake for the Democrats to look at the 42-year-old. You know, they trotted some guy out the other day who was 42 years old, I think it was, married, two kids, and he's on the minimum wage. And like, see, it's not just young people. This is why we need to raise the minimum wage. And I'm sitting there thinking, what an absolute indictment of your administration's economic policies that that guy can only find a minimum wage job. You know, the point is grow the economy, create good paying jobs so that people who aren't just starting out are able to find those jobs. That's what we've had in other times in our economy. And if that means we need to do some job training with our community colleges and things like that, then let's do it. The key is not to have everyone working at a minimum wage.
Is that a place where you could see maybe some compromise? You mentioned community college training, maybe some bipartisan compromise?
I think there's broad support in Iowa, again, bipartisan, for looking at worker training. You know, when we converted welfare into workfare in the 90s, we kind of did the Tommy Thompson model out of Wisconsin. We gave people a lot of support to get the job skills they need. We provided childcare. We provided other things they needed while they were getting those skills. But once they got those skills for jobs that were actually available in the marketplace, they had a certain amount of time, and after that, you were done. And you know what happened? People didn't end up living in the streets. The roles went down. The welfare roles went down dramatically, and there was not all of this, you know, negative. I guess, negative side to it that the liberals were saying would happen. What we found is that when people need to work, they tend to work. But right now, today, we have it where it's actually more comfortable not to work than to work, and that needs to be reversed. I believe in a safety net. I've had friends that have gone through job losses when companies moved to Mexico and all that sort of thing. I absolutely believe in helping people. But it should never be more comfortable not to work than to work. That's not a safety net. That's a feather bed.
The proposed changes to the renewable fuel standards seem to signal that the administration is moving away from grain-based alternatives to the to conventional fuels. What would you do in Washington to work in a bipartisan manner on energy policy that would benefit Iowans and still have national appeal?
Well, that's really one of the things I'm passionate about. I mean, my number one goal is to get the economy going again to help spur the pro-growth and the spending restraint to get the debt under control. But after that, you know, I do have a certain amount of expertise in ag policy and in energy policy, and I really think I would be a refreshing voice in the House Republican caucus, which is sometimes all too often dominated by the fossil fuel folks. I'm not against fossil fuels. We need oil. We need the other options. You know, I want to get the Keystone Pipeline done and things like that. But we also need to make sure that there aren't unnecessary barriers to the expanded use of renewable fuels like ethanol and biodiesel. So I would fight hard for the RFS. Right now, Iowa's entire congressional delegation, House and Senate, is united in support of the RFS. I would certainly want to continue that trend and try to take the facts out to the people who a lot of people think that, you know, that only renewables get federal support. And so I would be very happy to sit down with staff and members and explain to them everything that the oil industry continues to get, from tax credits that date back over 100 years to a federal petroleum mandate to petroleum pipeline loan guarantees to specialized tax structures that only they get. I mean, the playing field is actually tilted very heavily in the favor of oil. We would love a level playing field for renewables because, you know, today ethanol is the world's cheapest source of fuel octane. We would do just fine if there was actually a level playing field.
What are your thoughts on switchgrass?
Switchgrass. You're talking cellulosic ethanol. That's kind of a placeholder. My thoughts are I'm not sure that switchgrass will be the dedicated energy crop of choice as we go forward. I hear more people now talking about Miscanthus and giant Miscanthus, all these things. I'm not an expert on what it'll be, but there's no doubt that cellulosic ethanol is coming. You've got two projects in Iowa that are going to use corn stalks, which is another form of cellulose, to produce, and those will be up this year. So, you know, companies like DuPont don't spend hundreds of millions of dollars to build plants that they don't think will work. Personally, in Iowa, I think we'll see much more crop residues used for that. But is there could be some certain areas, and particularly in southern Iowa where I grew up, where you could see some dedicated energy crops on the more hilly country. But also as you get into further south or further west and it's drier, I think you'll see more opportunities for dedicated energy crops versus using commodities. But right now in Iowa, most of our land, we can grow corn and have food and feed off of the corn kernel, and then have fuel directly off of the stock that, you know, we leave a certain amount in the field for agronomic and environmental reasons, and the rest is extra, so let's use it for fuel. So I still think that's probably the model that makes the most sense in Iowa.
Okay. Even with a former governor heading up the Ag Department, former Iowa governor, farmers were kept in limbo for years over the new farm policies. How would you represent the interests of agriculture and rural communities and environment and from a district that is heavily urban?
Well, you know, you say it's heavily urban, but I think I've seen statistics that show 25% of the people in the 3rd District have someone in their family that's connected directly to agriculture. It doesn't mean they farm, but there's a lot of agribusiness as well. And I think there's no doubt that when ag does well, Iowa does well. So I don't care whether you're selling shoes in Council Bluffs or selling insurance in Des Moines, how agriculture does is going to have a huge impact on your personal financial well-being. And so when it comes to the Farm Bill, this is something that sets me apart from most people in my race. You know, you get people say, I wouldn't vote for the Farm Bill. Well, I would have reluctantly voted for the most recent Farm Bill because it would have been better than reverting back to the underlying law. I actually think there's guys in this race that don't understand that if that Farm Bill fails, we go back to a 1950s era law that would have been extremely costly for taxpayers and very horrible for farmers. It would have been a nightmare. Now, were there some good reforms in the Farm Bill? Yes, there were. We got rid of direct payments. There were some reductions to the SNAP program. There were other things that were done in there. But there was a lot left undone that I think you don't just sit back and say, well, the Farm Bill passed, we're done. It's the starting point. And so we should have moved more toward an insurance system for farmers where they have the skin in the game and away from the target prices and what we call counter-cyclical payments. There was a real opportunity to do that was missed in this Farm Bill. There's additional reforms and reductions that need done to the nutrition side in this Farm Bill. And so I see it as, yeah, you know, at least it was a couple of steps forward and it avoided us from going back to that permanent law. But there's a lot more work to be done.
So you're campaigning to join Congress at a time when approval rating is in the teens. What do you think you could how do we get to this point?
Well, you know, I think that I get asked that a lot. Why in the world do you want to go to Congress? It's so dysfunctional. And I guess the fact of the matter is my wife and I, as we thought about this and prayed over it, we decided that's exactly why I need to run. Growing up, my mom taught me that if good people don't stand up, you get what you deserve. And I think sometimes in the last few cycles, we've gotten what we deserved. I care about my kids. I want them to have economic opportunities like I had. And if we don't send people out there that can do more than bang on a table, you know, they pound their fist on the table, they shake that fist in the air, they put out a press release, and they call it good. I'll bang on the table when it's called for, okay? And I know how to write a press release. But that's not where it stops. You know, you have to sit down at that table, you have to roll up your sleeves, and you have to be willing to work with people to find solutions. And I've got a track record of doing that, whether it's on renewable fuels policy or whether it's even on my time with the State Central Committee for the Republican Party. We had a diverse cast of characters on that board when I was there, some that didn't really talk to each other. They'd talk about each other, but not to each other. But we got them to vote with us time after time after time by focusing on the big picture. I guess the way I put it is you got to know when to negotiate on the details and know when to draw a line in the sand on principle. And I think with my 20-plus years of advocating for conservative candidates and issues, I think I've learned that skill set. But it's also a mentality. We need to send people out there that are willing to put in the time and the effort to roll up the sleeves and find that common ground that we can work on. I'll do it. Can't do it alone. My hope is that there's other people out there running for Congress today that feel like me, that we understand the frustration of why people bang that fist on the table, but we can't stop there. We have to actually then do something to change the direction of the country.
So how can you protect your conservative ideals and advocate for your values, but at the same time compromise? Where's the compromise?
Well, that's that skill set I was talking about. You know, there. You know, if we're talking about how much to reduce taxes, I don't think that if, you know, the House passes a tax cut that's X and the Senate passes a tax cut that's Y, and you meet somewhere in the middle, or hopefully the House does a good job and we meet a little closer on the House's side. You know, there's some people out there that says if you accept a compromise between the House and the Senate that's one penny less than the House position, you've compromised your principles. I just don't buy that. You know, if we can take a big step forward, a meaningful – I'm not talking about crumbs from the table here. But if we can take a big, meaningful step forward on tax reform, on cutting taxes, just as one example, on cutting spending, you know, we're probably not going to get a balanced budget in year one, okay? I'd like to see it no later than year four or five, because otherwise it's just a recipe to kick the can down the road. But we can work toward those steps. Now, on the flip side, if it's a principle, if it's an ethic, if it's heading in the wrong direction, I'm not going to negotiate over how fast or slow we move in the wrong direction. You know, if someone wants to raise taxes on a net basis, they're going to have to go somewhere else to find 218 votes. They might as well not knock on my door. But that's what I'm talking about, where you learn where to negotiate over the fine points, but where to draw the line in the sand and say, no, that's not what's right for this country, whether it's economically, socially, whatever.
Are there any areas that you could see yourself compromising with the Democrats? Besides, I mean, you mentioned the Senate, and there's a chance the Senate could be Republican. So where with the Democrats do you see yourself compromising?
Well, you know, and I don't know if it's the right word is compromise, but where could we actually find common ground to work together? Energy policy would be one where you see it being more regional than necessarily partisan. But I also think, look, we got some big challenges coming up with Social Security and Medicare. And right now, it's just a political football while these programs are on pace to not being able to pay the benefits that were promised. And so I really hope we can have some adults come together and decide that these issues are too important to our seniors to continue to just play political football with them and sit down and have a true bipartisan compromise. The only way that we will maintain the fiscal solvency of Social Security and Medicare is with a bipartisan compromise. It cannot be one party going forward on their own, because the history has shown the other party will just beat them up over it and use scare tactics. So that's an area where I'm not sure that's going to happen on day one, but we need to start doing that. And I also, and maybe I'm naive here, but I'm an optimistic guy at nature. I still think there are a lot of Democrats that see the need for tax simplification. Our tax code is insane. A standard family with a couple of kids who owns a house should be able to fill out their taxes on a postcard. And I don't think there's a lot of Democrats that feel differently on that to me. Now, I want to see those rates down too. And maybe that'll be a part where we have to be better negotiators.
Nearly every candidate running for office says they would like to cut the budget, bring down the deficit. Where would you make cuts? What departments would you make cuts?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to look at everything. And let's start with things I support. I support a strong defense. But, you know, Chuck Grassley has shown us that any area of government where you spend that much money, there is waste and fraud and abuse. And so let's look right there. Let's try not to get into so many military conflicts. You know, I want to have a strong military, but I think that we should be very judicious in when we use it, because it's pretty expensive when you take it, when you deploy troops. I think that there are a number of anti-poverty programs and housing programs that are duplicative at the federal level and work against each other, and you could probably combine those and block grant them. We send money to D.C. so that it comes back to local police departments. That doesn't make a lot of sense. Heck, let's start easy. Let's stop funding federal presidential campaigns with taxpayer money. Let's start there. And let's look at some of the stuff that the corporations get that is more or less corporate welfare. There's a lot of programs for overseas stuff that I don't think are necessarily needed. So there's a lot of places we could look at, I think.
So do you think we're spending enough on national defense, or do you think we're spending money in the wrong areas on national defense?
I think what we have to do is prioritize taking care of our troops and their families and our veterans, and then see where you can be smarter in how we spend money on the procurement of the weapon systems and things like that. I am not a military expert, but I haven't worked with I was able to attend the National Security Seminar maybe 2 years ago now at the U.S. Army War College. And so I got to spend a week with a whole bunch of military colonels They were there to get their master's in strategic studies with the hope that they'd become a general someday, I think. Fascinating talking to them. So there's people I can reach out to. There's people like Chuck Grassley. They've been doing this for a long time. So I'd want to look with them and pitch in, roll up my sleeves, and try to help out. But the key thing is we should not treat – you know, my wife's an Army brat. And so she's lived in that housing, base housing. She's lived overseas on military bases. And we don't always do very well by the people that we ask to put themselves in harm's way for us. And we don't always do very well by their families. And that's something where I would not want to see spending reduced like the president proposed in his budget. I think there's other places we could look at.
So we're going to switch to immigration reform. I'd love to go into that further, but I'm understanding that we have a finite amount of time. Immigration reform is an issue important to Iowa, but has stalled in Congress. What immigration reforms would you support?
Yeah, I think if you actually, and this is here where let's get something done, all right? If you want to play political football, we can, you know, me and the Democrats and the liberals can throw around slogans all day. If you want to get something done, first thing you're going to have to do is secure the border. Now, to me, that's actually more of a national security issue because if you can walk across the border with a shirt on your back, you can walk across the border with a backpack that has a dirty bomb in it, and it's just a matter of time till that happens. But because of the federal government not fulfilling its promises made during the 1986 federal immigration reform, you just don't have trust. So you've got to start by securing the border. I mean, Chuck Grassley, for goodness sake, says the worst vote he's ever cast in the U.S. Senate was for that immigration reform in 1986. He's cast a lot of votes. If that's the worst one, I think it tells you just how deep set this problem is. Now, So I think you have to start by that to even have a discussion that can bring people together across the aisles. Number two, I'm in favor of reforming the legal immigration pathway. We adopted a boy from South Korea, my son. Love him to death. It was a nightmare to go through that process. It was took too long. Too many months of his life were spent apart from Tina and I because of the system. We need to look at the current quotas that come in. A lot of them date back to like the 1920s, I've been told, that, you know, the needs of our economy, the needs of the world have changed. I'd like to see us, heaven forbid, maybe actually put a little bit of merit in there. Right now, it's kind of like if you have a family member, you move to the front of the line. Well, what about some of the world's best and brightest people want to come and live and work and be productive in the United States? How is that not good for us? Whether it's academic achievement, whether it's artistic achievement, let's sit down and talk about how to put, not solely, but have at least something in there for merit. We need a guest worker program that works. If we had a guest worker program that works, it would really take the pressure off of illegal immigration, both at the low-end wage scale, but also at the very high-end wage scale where we have skill sets that are out there. So that's where I want to start. And then I'll be very honest with you. I do not believe in granting shortcuts to people to become citizens based on the sole factor that they've broken a law. I think that discriminates against the law-abiding citizens who I know are waiting in other countries to come here. And I could give you numerous personal examples of that that I know of personally where these people are waiting to come here legally. And if we let people cut in front of them based on the fact that they broke a law, that just seems backwards to me. So that's probably where I would draw the line on that. But let's reform the legal system and secure the border.
Now we're going to switch to climate change. I wish I had more time to talk to you about all these issues. So 97% of scientists say that climate change is a real thing. Is that enough for you? And regarding climate change, what would you like to see done in Congress?
Well, let's first of all start out with a couple of facts. The fact is scientific truth has never been determined by a poll of scientists. There was a time when 97% of the people thought the world was flat. When I was in grade school, 97% of the scientists were worried about the oncoming ice age to the effect of where there were serious plans being promoted to Congress to launch rockets into space to put things, was it coal dust or something up in the atmosphere so that it would actually speed global warming. Okay, and this was in the 70s. This is not too long ago, and it was a very costly program then. And if they're right today, it would have been a horrible mistake. So I'm more along the lines of Iowa State climatologist Elwin Taylor on at least this part. The climate is changing. The climate has always changed. So the real question is, should the federal government do anything about it, and could it do anything about it? And so far, I've yet to see a plan that would suggest anything would be positive. Let's take the cap and trade program that was promoted a few years ago. Iowa State looked at that, Dr. Brown up there, and determined that if we implemented that law, world greenhouse gas emissions would go up, because you would force the petrochemical industry out of the Gulf Coast and into China and Asia. In the Gulf Coast, we're efficient and we use natural gas to power these, to power the manufacturing down there. In Asia and China, they use coal and they're less efficient. So here you are, you have these people who say, oh my goodness, we have to have a government solution to climate change right now today, so we're going to pass this bill, and it would have actually made the problem worse that they say is out there. I think that the man-made emissions are fairly minor compared to what happens naturally, and I think that the climate is not changing that much more than it ever has as you go through different cycles, and I don't think that there's a government solution out there that makes a lot of sense right now.
So you mentioned your two children earlier, and a talking point that a lot of supporters of climate change legislation are say, I want this world to be a safe place for my children and grandchildren. Are you worried about the way the world is going to be when your kids are your age?
8,000 years ago, where we're sitting right now was under a glacier. So the world's warmed up, and we're okay. I think that it is quite a bit of takes a pretty big ego by man, and we as mankind, we have a pretty big ego to think that we have so much impact on the world. The world is pretty good at balancing itself, and that's what we've seen here recently with some of these trends not following the models. You know, they haven't produced a model that works yet that can backcast and accurately predict what happened in the past when you know the data points. Then you take the models and you say, okay, let's put this model in place 10 years ago. Did it accurately predict the last decade? No, none of the models did. And yet on the basis of these models and guesses and conjectures, we're going to cripple the U.S. economy. That's not a good bet for my children. It's not a good bet for any children. I understand that there are people who want government control of the economy. I understand that there are people who want to make money off of this. But it's not something that that I would support. And I'm much more interested in getting the economy growing. Now, I'm a conservative, which means I like to conserve. I think there are market forces that can be brought to bear. Look at renewable fuels. Why wouldn't we want to do things to get more consumer choice available for renewable fuels? And because it's good for national security, it's good for our economy and farmers, and it reduces tailpipe emissions from a human health standpoint, but it also has a lower carbon footprint. So to the extent that people care about carbon emissions, it'd be good for them too. Let's find things that are good for the environment, good for the economy, and that we can bring market forces to bear. I think history shows that those are much more effective in the long term than anything like cap and trade, which, you know, I call cap and trade at the time galactically bad public policy, because not only would have it crippled our economy, but it would have actually increased world emissions of carbon, which is what the proponents of the bill said they wanted to decrease. I mean, it was one of the dumbest ideas ever put out there. And so I'm not interested in going down that road.
I'd like to finish up with just a couple questions on the Affordable Care Act. And the U.S. House has held dozens of votes to either repeal, defund, or otherwise dismantle the Affordable Care Act. President Obama will not sign legislation repealing, defunding, or dismantling this legislation. But the law remains unpopular, with most polls showing – this is a question from my executive director, so this is why I'm reading it verbatim. With most polls showing more people opposed to rather than in support of the law, what are your ideas for revising the law?
Well, I do think we ultimately need to repeal it. You know, and I'm not one of these guys that gets worried about, well, do you repeal it in one bill and then, you know, replace it in the second bill, or do it all in the one? You know, I'm not saying there aren't, you know, a few good parts of it. You know, I think there's general consensus that letting kids stay on their parents' insurance while they go to college and different things like that are good. And I'd have to pull out my I actually dug into it once and wrote down some notes one time of things that were okay, but it was a pretty short list. I fundamentally don't think that the government can mandate that an employer provide a service. I think that's just against our constitutional values. I don't think that a government should be able to force you to mandate that you buy a private product. It's wrong. But more importantly, it doesn't fix the problem. The problem is healthcare costs are going up too quickly. And it was actually getting the consumers out of the decision-making process with healthcare is when that happened. It happened during World War II. That's when the employer health system started. We don't have time to go into it, but it had to do with when the government put wage controls on industry as a part of the war powers to attract good employees that would help them be more productive and meet and beat their quotas, and they get those big bonuses. The manufacturers said, hey, I can only pay you X, but I'll give you health insurance, or I'll give you – so that's where these employer-based benefits came from. That is also when – the inflation rate of health costs started going up faster than normal inflation, because right now today, if I go have a major heart procedure done, I'm going to get a bill 6 months later, and I'll pay the deductible and I'll pay the copay, and that'll be that. And if I had shopped around, instead of paying maybe $60,000 for this procedure, I might have been able to find a place that paid $40,000 that was just as good. Go to doctor, same experience, same success rate, same training, et cetera. But I don't even think about it. And if you go ask them what their prices are, most of the times they won't even tell you. We have to have price transparency and a system that encourages and rewards consumers for being frugal. It doesn't mean settling for a lower standard of care. The beauty of the free market is that you, by literally hundreds of millions of individuals making their own personal value judgments, you get to a collective wisdom, a collective knowledge or intelligence, you might say, that's always smarter than the 20 smartest people in the world sitting in a room. And I believe that. It's worked for every other sector of our economy. It can work for healthcare to get the highest quality product at the lowest possible price. And so I want to see us move back toward more consumer involvement, not less consumer involvement. And I mean, look at the stats. It's going to cut 2.4 million jobs out of our economy. It's going to add $1 trillion to the debt. I would say that Obamacare is probably the second policy that I have labeled galactically bad public policy. And at the end, and the reason it's not just bad public policy because of all the bad things I mentioned, the reasons it's galactically bad is just like on cap and trade, where it didn't accomplish what the people who even supported it wanted to accomplish. The CBO says at the end of a, quote, successful, unquote, implementation of Obamacare, you're still going to have 30 million people uninsured. So we're going to go through billions in taxes, all this freedom lost, people have lost their plans, lost their doctors. It's a huge wet blanket on the economy. It's going to add to the debt. And at the end of the day, we'll still have more than half the people that we started with uninsured. That is not a good solution.
In regard to the employer mandate, in a recent debate at the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition, you equated this mandate with forcing people to work for hate groups like the Ku Klux Klan or neo-Nazis, and you've gotten some criticism for these comments. Do you think they've been taken out of context?
Well, there's no – have you looked up what I said?
I did.
Okay. Well, then what you'll know is the criticism is not what I said. I never once mentioned the – you just mentioned the Affordable Health Care Act. I didn't mention the Affordable Health Care Act. What I said was is it is – I was asked a specific question about the role of the federal government dictating to religious institutions. And I said, under our Constitution, the federal government should not be allowed to force a religious institution to provide a good or service that runs counter to the tenets of their faith. For example, the Catholic Church should not be forced to provide a service that the Pope says is a sin. That is a constitutional protection in our society. And so I did not equate anything that they said I did. I talked about the pain, the frustration, and probably even the anger that, let's say, in one example, a devout Catholic might feel if the federal government tried to get them to spend their own money providing a service that the Pope says is a sin. It would be the same pain, anger, and frustration that I think certain people would feel in other lines of work providing goods or services to people that they fundamentally disagree with. No government should be able to force a religious institution across that line, and the First Amendment of our Constitution backs that up. I would love to have someone on the other side step up, actually pull a sentence out of what I actually said, and tell me they disagree with it. Because by attacking me for what I said, I'm left to believe, and this came straight from Stacey Apple's campaign, I'm left to believe that Stacey Apple must think it's okay for the federal government to dictate to religious institutions that they provide services that violate their religious beliefs. That is an ultra-liberal position. That decimates the First Amendment of our Constitution. If that's truly where she's at, and she's attacking me for taking the other side. So if that's truly where she's at, that means there would be no religious freedom in Stacey Apple's America. And that, quite frankly, should scare people.
So you feel it was totally out of context?
Well, there's no question. I mean, you can read what I said, and what they then wrote about were using words that I never said. They mentioned Affordable Health Care Act. They mentioned corporate. One of them was going off on Hobby Lobby. I didn't say any of that. So, and I didn't make any comparisons that they do. What they're trying to do is what we've seen more recently out of the Obama administration. Even some of the more well-known, and I hate to say this, but more what I would call more liberal national reporters have come out and said that even they are disgusted at the fact that the Obama administration just seems to lie as a matter of daily interaction with the press, and that it hadn't been that way in the past with other administrations of either party. What you see here are people that are intentionally misrepresenting my words to try to score political points. But what it really exposed, see, we've been trying to get Stacey Apple to talk about Obamacare for months. I've called her out on several occasions, and she never did. Well, this was the first time, so we got her to kind of take the bait. This was the first time she's made a comment, her campaign has made a comment on Obamacare. Go look at their website. It's not there. On Obamacare, and what she did was take an ultra-liberal position that would basically rip a huge chunk of the First Amendment to the Constitution out and roll it up and throw it away. So I think she's really starting to let it be known just how out of touch she is. But I don't think there's any outside of the ultra-liberals in the United States that don't believe in religious freedom. I don't think there's any sentence I said that I think a normal person would disagree with. If you find one, I'd love to sit down with them.
Is there anything before we wrap this up that you would like to add or something you think voters should know about you that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would just say that, you know, as I go out and talk to Republicans around, you know, because we are in the nomination phase, I ask them to look for a candidate that checks three boxes. Who can stand up to the scrutiny of this race and these types of distortions that the liberal attack machine will bring in the fall? I've got a track record of doing that. I've worked with the media for 20 years. I don't have the baggage that some other folks may have, rightly or wrongly. We know that's how they're going to come after the Republican. So I think I checked that box. We need someone who will vote right. Quite frankly, there are some key differences between me and my opponents, but we're all conservative folks. I think we all kind of check that box. And then the third one, though, is who can be the most effective. And it's not enough to just vote right. You have to go that next step to roll up the sleeves that we talked about earlier. You have to go that next step and roll up your sleeves and actually try to work hard to get stuff done. I've got a track record of doing that. And so I hope that the voters will look at those three boxes and see that I check them and choose me. And I think that's why I've been able to attract the support of people from across the political spectrum, from John King, who's Steve King's brother, who's one of my co-chairs, to Carmen Bowl, who's a well-known conservative, to Dr. Gansky, former congressman, who's more of a mainstream Republican, to even Chuck Offenberger, the former Iowa boy at the Des Moines Register, who's an independent voter, has endorsed me. To win this seat and to be an effective congressman, you don't have to give up your conservative principles, but you do have to be respectful and thoughtful and hardworking. And if you do that, you can capture a large segment of the vote, and that's the type of campaign we're trying to run.
All right. Well, thank you, sir, so much for your time, and I really appreciate you and Anna setting this up, and I hope to see you again.
All right. Anytime. Thank you.